The following program is intended for mature audiences.
The following program contains strong language. It is intended only for mature audiences.
This is a previously recorded episode of the IT in the D Show.
IT in the D. Networking Detroit, one beer at a time.
ITinTheD.com.
All right, so hey, welcome back to a third segment of this the special one-off IT and the D Show. Still don't know what we're going to call it. Still just rolling.
It's like an Iron Man match.
It is. It's right.
IT and the D, black stuff.
That's what we do. IT and the D does black stuff.
Hey, HuffPost has black voices. I don't know. We should have like an IT and the D, black voices.
And IT and the D in Royal Oak in black stuff.
Right.
Still not from Detroit.
Hey, red tape.
I know.
Red carpet. We talked about
right.
this.
Yeah. I got it. I remember that.
True.
Episode 150. Throwback.
Hey, you guys know how I feel about Detroit.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I've heard some things.
All right. So we've finally gotten ourselves up to current events. We're here with today's world. So, you know, I guess let's talk about what went on over the course of this past week. So you had an incident where a man was held down and gunned down outside of a store. You had another incident where a man announces that he's got his permit to carry. And
Philando Castile.
Yep. And then is shot four times by an officer. Then you have the events in Dallas where you've got five police officers shot, where, you know, you've got people now screaming that, oh, well, you know, that guy discredits, you know, the entire Black Lives Matter movement and all that stuff. So I guess, you know, we've talked about why and how we've gotten to the place where these situations are happening. But so I guess, let's talk about those two incidents specifically, and then, you know, how things like Dallas happen. And it wasn't just Dallas. I mean, you had stuff going on in St. Louis and Tennessee and a few other places.
28 this month alone.
Oh, I'm talking about attacks on police officers.
On police. Attack on police. Sorry.
Attack on police around here too now.
Yep.
Like it's moving up.
Detroit area? I haven't heard that.
I just saw something that was recent.
Well, okay. I remember the classic one where the guy walked in the precinct over there off 7 Mile in Woodward.
That was
crazy.
I have a question to pose and thoughts on it. The thing about this is these stories that we're sharing are why Black people react with hostility to police. I always hear that. Well, why don't the Black people, why aren't they just nicer when the police officers show up? You ever seen one of those movies where the guy gives a guy an ultimatum and the ultimatum is something like, you know, give me the money and I'll kill you?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, then fuck you. Like,
you're not getting the money, then I guess we're going to go.
You know, I'm just going to hold on to the money until you kill me. You know,
luck finding it, right?
Yeah, you know, that's what's happening. Where when police, like, I remember my business partner was explaining to me that he never looks a police officer in the eyes. He said every time in his life he ever looked a police officer in the eye, they pulled him over. He said he's so afraid when he sees police officer, he always immediately looks away or he looks down, walking or driving. That is inbuilt fear from all the way back to slave catchers. We were just afraid to look that part. Like Kari was just sharing his story. He does not deal with police officer on duty. Mm-mm. It's not that he is like he disrespects the badge in America as an entity. Mm-mm. Kari is afraid for his life.
I mean, what you're saying, and I think Marcus's background is a whole lot closer to mine. Just
I'm even closer than yours. He's from the suburbs. I'm gonna
yours too. So I mean, it is one of those things where I've just seen the situations where, I'll be honest too, in the sense of I've had guns drawn on me by non-police officers too. But I always think to myself, if I were dealing with the average urban or Black criminal that I would interact with possibly and whatever dealings and interactions, I have a way of reasoning myself out of the situation if I'm interacting with a criminal. Because the element that always presents itself with police officers, and Billy was about to point out this too, is even when I'm talking to one cop and he's starting to reason, every time I interact with police officers, more cop cars start coming. And every time cops start coming, more police officers get out, and now you go from reasoning with one to reasoning with another. And one's I guess one's disposition may be different than the others. So I'm talking to one officer and he's like, all right, he's cool. But then the next officer's like, hey, what's happening? So I and Lord knows what they're dealing with.
You're having a good conversation with somebody. You might disagree, but then Bob comes in with his opinion, and then yes. Sarah comes in with her opinion, and then
it can easily become one. Right. It can become from one squad car, and I've seen it, and it's happened to me. It can go from one squad car to seven squad cars in a matter of
a minute,
30 right. seconds.
And right. since I told it's that story when we were offline, why don't I go ahead and tell it? So,
yeah, please do.
When I was running a company in Troy, and I was driving to Warren to my daughter's soccer game, right? So I'm in a hurry. And there's in between, I think it's either John R. or something in Chicago. There's a speed trap on Chicago.
Yeah, it's between DeQuinder and Ryan.
That's right.
Because if you're DeQuinder going to the park right there,
I was going to the
right,
park.
That's right by my house.
Exactly. So that's the spot where it was pulled over. It's usually a guy on a motorcycle.
Yep. That's what they had set up a couple days ago. Right.
Exactly. So everybody that drives through there that gets pulled over is familiar with that. Whenever I see him pulling someone over, it was just him, right? But for whatever reason, when I was pulled over, as I was going to my daughter's soccer game, I pulled in, turned the car off. Next thing I knew, I was surrounded by six police officers for what? I don't know.
For being a monster.
And so, you know, as he comes up to the car, you know, I have my license and my registration. He's like, you know, where were you in a rush to? And I'm like, well, I was running late for my daughter's soccer game, which is right there. They kept me in that car for another 25 minutes while they just sat outside of my car having a conversation.
Yeah.
And I, as you were talking about the physiological reaction to that, I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't get angry, couldn't yell about it.
No. You can't. And if you were to get out the car, that could possibly be your death.
And so
if you were to raise your right. voice, that could possibly be your death. If you were to open your car door, if you were to make any movement,
if you would have made a call
could
to
be
your lawyer.
A justification.
Right.
As we saw even the Philando Castile in the mother. I mean, in the girl, the fiance.
Oh, my God. That woman.
You saw what happened to her phone. It's like they cuffed her for no reason.
Right. And my wife was asking me the question. She's like, what was going on over there? All of the parents were trying to figure out why were there six cop cars over there? What could possibly be? And I said, well, they just pulled me over for speeding. And it seemed excessive to everyone. Except for in the
cops. Except for you.
Right.
Except for the
right. Exactly.
Except for us.
And you.
Right.
Well, there's one of me. There's six cars. Seems about right. That seems about right.
And that. And that
magic. I'm surprised they didn't have seven.
Situation, you know, having, like I say, having a gun drawn on you, if you've ever had a gun drawn on you, is a scary situation. Because gun drawn on you generally means somebody is possibly ready to kill you. And when you don't know because you fit the description or, you know, a broken taillight.
And what's worse is you don't know what description you fit. Because right. as being a black person, you fit the description.
Sure.
But it could be anything from petty robbery to some dangerous lunatic that's out here killing everybody. And when it's the dangerous lunatic out here killing everybody, your life has become bomb prone.
Right.
You know?
Because even with the Castile issue, it says in the transcript that he says he matches the description because he had a wide nose.
Like us. Like
so
everyone that's
black.
So
he's black. So that's your description is really.
I got put over in the description once. I thought that was interesting.
It's crazy, man.
One time I got pulled over, I was driving around in my mom, and I got put over for being a guy in a red Grand Am. Everybody knows Grand Ams. All those bastards are red.
Like it's just like
Grand Ams are red.
That's the only color they made.
Red is also the number one pulled over car color as well.
So I get pulled over, and my mom was drunk, bless her soul, because she just, you know, she liked to drink more and she liked to be a mom. And so she, you know, I was like, Mom, be quiet. You know? Now, here's the thing. My experience with police have all been good except for maybe two. Right? I have this way of preemptively confusing police before they want to kill me, right? Mm-hmm. So this is what I do. This is my strategy to preemptively confuse police before they kill me. When a police officer pulls up to my door, I always say hi first. instead of like rolling it down, because we know as black people, what we do is we roll the window down, we kind of look away from the thing, and we're quiet until they say stuff to us.
The difference with me, I don't do any damn thing until the loud horn tells me.
Until they tell you. See, so this is what I do. Police officer comes over to my car door. I say, "Oh my God, hi! I'm happy you're here." Right? They go. Immediately, they're like, "What?" Because they're not expecting that. Because they're scared of me, and I'm scared of them. So they know that I'm a black guy, I could be dangerous. I immediately hit them with the, "I'm happy you're here." They go, "What?" I was like, "You know, I'm just happy to see police out here in the community doing their job." Right? Like, I'm just happy to see it out here. You know, what's going on? What do you need? Right? They're like, I always watch them process. Always. They always go, "Hmm." And then their demeanor changes. They go, "Oh, well, we were just doing this thing." Because the one time I really was in the wrong, I was driving. I think I was, it was out, I was three, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I was driving around going 20 miles per hour on 8 Mile. Clearly, I'm suspicious. I was looking for a client's house to drop something in his mailbox, but I couldn't remember what his address was, and I didn't have GPS at the time, and so I was just trying to, like, through visual memory, remember how to get there. So this police officer pulls up behind me, of course, because I'm driving 20 miles per hour on 8 Mile. He pulls over. I hit him with the, "Hi, officer, how's it going?" Blah, blah, blah. I tell him, he goes, he checks my stuff. It's my grandma's car. I wasn't on the registration, blah, blah, blah. I told him that story, which sounds criminal, right? I'm outside at 3 o'clock in the morning looking for a mailbox to drop some stuff into. Then I say, he gets ready to walk away. I say, "Excuse me, officer." He stops, he turns around. I say, "How's that new Charger drive?" He got the new police that was when the Charger switched over. I said, "How does that new Charger drive?" So, "You know, it's different, it's lighter, blah, blah." We had a full conversation about the car. After that, I said, "Hey, you know, I'll see you around sometime," right? He said, "Oh, yeah, great." Gets in the car, drives away. The guy forgot to give me a ticket. The guy, he completely forgot. We had a genuine moment oh my God, I love these
cars. The only thing I've done, and I'm going to let you guys see it, I did the Magic Johnson. I decided to take a photo ID smiling as hard as I could.
See, I take
the Magic Johnson.
Man, Carrie looks happy.
Yes, I figured that with
this, I just gotta tell you though, this name, if it came across my desk on a resume, you are not getting hired. Carrie Bayette Frazier.
Exactly.
Man, he's black
I'm
as hell.
I'm smiling from cheek to cheek, and I said to myself that this ID is if I have to share that ID, they'll say, "Hey,
see, Kari, that's why we always could get our picture done drunk, so that when they pull us over, they don't see the difference, you know."
This is how I am, officer.
It's like his eyes are always like this.
So I got pulled over one time. I had guns drawn on me. It was interesting. I was a teenager. I was 18, 19 years old, and we were heading to this event at Wayne State University. I was not a Wayne State University student. My friend Sears Taylor was. His name is Sears.
Was it Wayne State police officers?
No. We were on our way down. But we pulled up next to a police officer. We're driving my friend's parents' car. So it's Lincoln. He was from Grosse Pointe Farms. Real nice house. Huge house. Nice big car. Well, back when the cars were like the size of the Bobolo boat, right? And we pull up next to his car.
Excuse me, excursion.
But we're on our way to this Campus Crusade for Christ event. They're now called Crew because Crusade just doesn't go over well branding wise anymore. So that's why they changed their name.
Why?
We're on our way downtown, and I want to say we're at Harper. We're Harper, and we pull up next to a cop car, and the light the light is red, and so we're stopped, and then the light turns green, and they don't move. And so we're like, "All right, we'll just go." And so we're dressed for this party, and it's a retro party. My buddy Sears is dressed like a pimp, like a 70s pimp, like the big fly collar, and he's driving a Lincoln, right? And Lincoln Continental. And my buddy Andy is wearing these torn-up jeans because he's supposed to look like he's from the 80s. And I'm just wearing whatever I'm wearing because it's late 90s. I'm like, I don't care. I'm not going to do this. So we get pulled out of the car. Well, the cops are walking up to the car, guns drawn. Two white guys, one black guy. Two white guys in the car, one black guy in the car, me being the black guy. Cops come alongside the car. They both have their guns drawn. They pull the window. We put the window down, and they ask, "Did you see us there at the stoplight?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, we saw you at the stoplight." Like, "Well, when it turned green, you just went, and you passed us. And that's disrespectful." We're like, I didn't know that was illegal to pull off at a legal green light. But I'm not saying anything because I'm, you know, I'm a 19-year-old kid. This is my first experience. And so they got their guns unholstered. I'm freaking out. Thankfully, my friends happen to be white in the car, so I don't have to freak out as badly. But they start to frisk us. They stop and frisk us, and they say, hey, you know, you guys fit the description of some car thieves. This kind of car was stolen nearby, so we got to check you. I'm like, so you're saying that two suburban-looking white dudes and a black dude stole a car from this area? Like, I know you're just making stuff up, because this configuration doesn't happen.
Is that marijuana I smell?
This doesn't happen, right? Mm. So we get pulled over, and we're getting frisked, and they frisked the first guy. And the first thing my friend says is, officer, the reason I'm dressed this way is, because he looks like he's a 70s pimp and he's driving a Lincoln Continental. He's like, the reason I'm dressed this way is, he's like, that has nothing to do with it. So they frisk him. And they frisk my buddy Andy. Got anything that's going to poke me? No. Got anything that's going to poke me? No. They get to me. I don't have anything on me. But they ask me, hey, you got anything that's going to poke me? And I go, nothing illegal, officer. The officer took his hands off me immediately. I just thought it was pretty funny. After I was just being a snarky little kid. Thankfully, no, now I'm like, God, I could have got my ass shot. Yeah. I could have really got myself shot.
Could have.
But I'm that guy. And my mom was always like, the guy, you're always that guy who's lipping off at people. And now I'm going, I can't do this. So I got pulled over several weeks ago now. I had my mom. I had your mom. I had my niece and you in the car. Thank you. We got pulled over. I was going well over the speed limit. I got pulled over. I didn't say anything when this cop walked up to the window. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay. He's like, hey, you know how fast you're going? It's like, I got you going at 90. I was like, well, I was going right around really about 80. He's like, okay, all right. So he gave me 80. But my hands were right here. Yep. My everything was out by the time he got there. Yep. Just before the police shootings. But it is well known for black people that you have your stuff out before they get to the window.
Because you're not trying to pop no glove boxes.
Right. Anymore. It's in the glove box. No, they're not going to let you
because
reach
that's
for
what
the
happened
glove
to Castell. That's what happened to Philando Castell.
Now, see, I'm like, so there's a question I have. One of the questions I have about the video, because again, a situation I've never seen play out. Why were they asking the passenger of the vehicle for license ID and registration?
But I've dealt with that too.
Pulled out. We're always pulled out on the passenger.
If you are a passenger, they will still ask for your ID.
But and they were asking him to provide the registration of the vehicle,
right?
Which I didn't.
The driver being asked is 100% legal. The second is an overstep of police authority. It is police stating.
But
okay, you are in the driver's seat. You're in the passenger seat. You're a passenger of this car. You have to provide ID as well. That is not at all legal.
But the way the questions are asked by any.
Do you have
any
ID?
Police officer, even when they search your car, it's illegal without a warrant. But they ask, "Do you mind if we search your vehicle?"
Right.
But then if you get into the gray area of,
because if you say no, then why are you hiding something?
No, yeah, you have to hide.
Do I want to say no and possibly end up getting shot?
Right. If they're gonna kill you, your job is to just do whatever they say.
Exactly. Yeah. So
and you say no, and suddenly they smell weed.
Right. Suddenly you're old.
Right.
I want everybody to remember that Philando Castell was in the car when they shot him.
Yep.
They didn't take him out of the car to shoot him.
Yeah.
They shot him in the car with his 4-year-old daughter in the back seat.
But what you saw with that video.
And his girlfriend next to him.
But what you saw in that video was. See, because what I saw was this. In my interpretation, that cop, the way the gun was shaking, he was scared for his life.
Real life.
So I was thinking that
from the outset.
Yeah, I was thinking that the cop the whole time
and just
couldn't handle the situation.
And did
itself.
You listen to the number of times he screamed the F word?
Oh my God, he's terrified.
He like I'm talking about after the shooting. Like he immediately knew he done effed up by the number of times he was blasting F out of his mouth.
Yeah.
But he's also on paid vacation.
But right. I mean, he's not in jail pending hearing. Yeah.
But he was shook. And that's really the scariest thing. It's the what Eric talked about and what Calvin talked about in the sense of all these ideas. If you believe that you're that threatened by a black man, you're going to be that scared and it's going to cause you to
Kari, one of the biggest problems, and Eric too, I want you guys to hit this, is that you haven't seen and you will never see another police officer condemning their own. And I think that's a
huge... Not true.
You have.
The woman that was posted... That she went nuts.
Oh, yeah. Okay. She went off.
All right. Because I was saying, well, that's very rare. You might get one or two.
It's a rarity.
It's
a rarity.
It's never official.
No, it's on her own Facebook page.
It's always a police officer that's just gone off the rails.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
I'll be surprised if they don't censure her.
For real.
They probably will.
It's very...
For conduct unbecoming.
Once again, it's always frustrating. And this brings us back to the events of Dallas. Okay. Now, I'm not trying to be the most controversial person in America, but I have a question to ask. Why is it,
Eric? Not trying to be the most controversial.
I'm not.
Person in
America. I'm just posing this question. Why is it that every time something happens to black people, they immediately throw Martin Luther King out there like it's time for everybody to be peaceful? The only black person that white people can apparently even fathom to lead anything is Martin Luther King because he was so nice to folks.
Okay.
Now, because
we talked about this
keep
outside.
Going with that,
it's not necessarily true because Martin Luther King has some radical ideas. Those just never make it to mainstream media.
But his ideas even on peace before his passing, because a lot of the thought processes in his before his murder transitioned, especially after his stay in Chicago, seeing what racism in the North was like as opposed to racism in the South, and just seeing the issues and the conflicts that exist in it, and really his stance against the Vietnam War of peace through all. So, like, I mean,
let me really comment on this because I was in a play at the Charles H. Wright, again, Rochester College, predominantly white college, did a lot of theater there, and I was in a play called The Meeting. It's by a playwright by the name of Jeffrey Stetson, and it's a play where he wrote. He made this fictional account of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X meeting in a room. And the whole play is just me and the other guy. So I'm Malcolm X. The other guy is Martin Luther King. And what he did was he took their speeches and he put them in conversation with each other. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of people don't know historically, and this is going right back to what you were saying, that's very true, is at the very beginning, Martin and Malcolm, very opposite sides of the spectrum. Nonviolent resistance by any means necessary. On this other side, right? Yeah. And then towards the middle of their careers, they were getting closer to each other. But, and by the end, they were saying that Martin Luther King Jr. sounded like a nonviolent Malcolm X. And they said that Malcolm X had lost his edge.
Yeah,
the stance, and I'm going to say this just in the sense of, like, I think that the autobiography of Malcolm X, as much as I know, like, especially Paul Lee, who's
have you read
Detroiter,
the whole thing?
Many a time.
Okay, all right, good.
I think it's required reading for any black male. But along with that, like, I mean, it's different things. But as he transitioned in life, especially with his trip to Mecca, his thought process was, man, a lot of my thought processes from the Nation of Islam are wrong and incorrect. And he transitioned towards human rights instead of fighting for black justice.
He was still for a black nation, but he said, I will allow other people to help us
of
now.
Human rights, though. Human rights are needed, not necessarily the whole idea of white people are the devil.
Right.
And,
right before
and
it's like no white people can help us.
Yes, no white people can help us. So like the ideal of human rights is completely different than the teachings of the Nation of Islam, which actually have a lot of Detroit roots through Fahd Muhammad.
Who was started in Detroit.
Exactly.
As
so,
was
like,
all
I mean,
the black stuff.
Many,
and the
many.
Stuff.
So, I mean...
all of the black
so
stuff.
A lot of the roots start here. But the thought process is completely different, completely contradicting. So his passing...
But it's the same
his ideals were completely different. And even with Muhammad Ali...
We've sanctified these people in their passing. We've made them palpable by mass consumption, because if Muhammad Ali was out in the world talking with Muhammad Ali was talking when he was alive, people wouldn't be out here all pro Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. But this is my question: why are black people always expected to rise above it and turn the other cheek? And at the same time, we're characterized as raging beasts.
Right. Okay, so let me.
So that's that. My okay. Like. So that
was what was so great. I mean, if you have a chance, I'm probably gonna send you all the link to me actually in this play because I did a bang up job. But
I believe in you.
But the context. Yes. I mean, the context. You the Malcolm, content.
You're still wearing Malcolm X's glasses.
I was Malcolm.
I wanted.
These were the glasses I was wearing.
I do.
the content of the play itself is so fantastic. There's a point where. Malcolm, I mean, in both, here's a funny thing. I did the play in Rochester Hills, and it was all white audience, predominantly. Very, very quiet, very respectful. Then we did it downtown at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History on Martin Luther King's birthday, which is their most busy, is the busiest day of the year for them. True. It was like Pentecostal church, like call and response. I'd say a line, people were like, amen, yeah,
well,
yeah,
say
yeah,
word.
Preach. And we, like in your theater, you're like, I am not used to this at all.
Culturally different.
Yeah, so it was an hour long play in Rochester. It was a 2 hour play in Detroit. Yes. But either way, in the play, there's a point where Malcolm X confronts Martin about, hey, I think they're going to erect statues to you before you're even through. Like me, you're not gonna hear anything about me, which is true. I mean, you don't have a Malcolm X Day. You don't have that. And he goes, doesn't it worry?
It's just not honored by American culture.
He's like, doesn't it worry you?
It's not a federal holiday.
So no. For those of you who don't know, Martin Luther King Jr. got the Nobel Peace Prize, right? And Malcolm X in his play, which is drawn from one of his speeches, says, doesn't it worry you at all that the people doing most of the oppressing are handing out all of the awards? It's like, they want you to be nonviolent here.
Facts.
But see what they'll say when you want to be nonviolent and they're talking about dropping napalm on brown-skinned babies in Vietnam. See what they'll say. And that's when Martin Luther King got assassinated because he moved on to talking about, I'm against the Vietnam War. And then he got killed. Right there.
It definitely was not.
Well, if they're going to knock off a president to further the Vietnam War, they will damn sure kill a black leader.
Yeah, absolutely.
Double facts.
But didn't Nobel invent dynamite anyway?
The issue is, it's like, hey, you know what? Here you're getting, we're told to be nonviolent, yet we're the only ones who remain nonviolent.
We're the only people.
Their
violence is being projected against us, and they only lift you when you say like. I just saw an article come out. Remember the lady who like covered the Klan member's body?
Yeah, yeah.
And now that article is circulating. Like, oh, listen to her about peaceful protest. Right. Let me tell you something about the Klan. Let me meet you outside. I don't give a damn about that. Come get some. Like, I will give out the address. There's this idea of you're supposed to be nonviolent in the face of stark oppression and chaos. Meanwhile, simultaneous narrative, we must nuke and destroy every terrorist. Because the only way to stop oppression and injustice is through force.
And I need to have my guns. Just in case someone breaks in my house.
And we're drone bombing people as we speak right now.
As we speak. Yeah.
Well, and we're sending robots in armed with explosives.
But we're removed from that. That's like video gameplay. But if we go to like the whole argument about, okay, after mass shootings, again, whole other story. Need to have a podcast called that. But
there we go.
You have, I mean, the number one argument when people are like, hey, I mean, whenever someone gets shot, 49 people got shot if you don't include the killer, right? So it's 50 people if you include him. So 49 people killed in this nightclub in Orlando.
Oh, yeah.
And my thought is, hey, you know what? Maybe we should go to, like, the Canadian way of things where you can, like, rent guns at the range, but you can't own them in your house. That seems like a nice middle ground. You could still go out and play.
Brother, the Second Amendment.
But the Second Amendment. I need to have this just in case the government rises up. You know what?
But what part of what? Well-regulated militia do you belong to?
Right. Nobody
talks about that second part.
Nobody belongs to the National Guard.
The first part.
Which is what the National Militia
They never talk about
is.
The second part.
Right. Nobody ever talks about that. So you've got that.
Well, I don't even know what that is. I belong to a marksman club. Right.
No,
I go shooting. I don't have no idea what a well-regulated militia
is. Actually the National Guard. That's who they are. But you've got people who say that. It's like, okay, you don't actually believe your government's going to rise up against you. Because what's your government rising up against you, you know what that looks like? The sniper killing cops because they believe that the government has risen up against them. And I don't believe that you should do that. But here's the other thing. What people often say is, I need guns to protect my home. I need these things to protect my home. Then, when black people try to protect themselves, we're told you should not have had a gun in the first place. Now, the Second Amendment doesn't talk about, oh, you know, licensing and CPLs. No, it's just you have the right to have a gun. That's what the Constitution says.
They need to
stop
Britain from taking their land back, as if Britain's going to be around in the next 10 years anyways.
Brexit, for the most part, Brexit left. Brexit stage left.
Even the dude that led the Brexit was like, this is silly. I'm out.
Yeah, can we do a do-over on that one? Yeah.
I didn't mean for that to work. I'm very Donald Trump about this. I was just kidding. Walls are expensive.
But the idea is, hey, if I have a gun for protection, I am not a violent person. There's like this disconnect between what you are actually calling for. Like, if someone breaks into my house, I will shoot and kill them. If someone tried to break into my house and try to get to my daughter or anything or to my wife, I'm killing, or to even my person, I kill them. That's what I do. That is inherently violent, okay? But people say self-defense isn't violence. It is actually violence. So when a black person says, I want to protect my person, these are the crimes against black bodies and brown bodies, we're said, well, then people realize it's actually a violent narrative. To protect yourself is inherently violent. But when black people do it, it's violent. But when white people do it, and I'm speaking in sweeping generalizations because there are some white allies who realize this, but
because that was a book, violent. Not a pamphlet.
Right.
Let's be clear.
It's a book, right. white allies. But it there's this idea that when white people say, I want to protect my family and want to rise up against the government should I ever need to,
that's noble.
It's not violent.
It's viewed as noble.
My friend Kent is funny. It's like anytime people are like, hey, you know what? I need to have guns just in case the government rises up against us. He'll always send them a picture of a tomahawk chopper shooting a missile in their house. He's like, good luck with that, Tonto.
It's like what are you going to do?
You go ahead and keep your AR-15. If the government wants your shit, that's cute.
No, it's amazing putting into perspective because me having a CPL and having SWAT shotguns and an AR-22 LR AR-15 and Glocks and
you're a terrorist, Bob.
Oh no, but it's like no one ever is like
is
Bob's
the government
violent.
Listening to this?
they're all legal and registered at the police station. But like no one ever is like Bob's violent.
Didn't
guy.
Help, didn't help Philando Castile. Right. Or was it the government?
Yeah. Did they say assassinate and Obama?
That's the old joke. Like what was the last words of Lee Harvey Oswald? It was the CIA.
It's like back up now. But
are we good?
We're all good.
We're good. We're good. So I'll back up because we don't know what we lost, and you could just edit this back.
Probably about 2-3 minutes, yeah.
Okay. So when we're talking about, you know, we know the names of Tamir Rice and Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and, you know, the names, you know, that have come up in the last few days shot by police unarmed, you know, unarmed black men. You know, Sandra Bland, you know, found in the jail, hung.
Sandra Bland was hung,
right?
Yes.
But here's so everybody wants to, you know, say something about the, oh, we don't really know what happened. Okay, so then here are names that you don't know, okay, or that you might not have heard. A lot of black people know these names, but a lot of white people might not know these names, right? So Eleanor Bumpers, Michael Stewart, Eula May Love, Arthur McDuffie, Amadou Diallo, Oscar Grant, Patrick Dorisman, Malice Green. Actually, that happened here in Detroit.
Yes.
Taisha Miller, Sean Bell. These are all people who were killed by the police, and we're not even talking about people who were just stopped, harassed, stopped and frisked. We're talking about people who were only killed, right? So what I want people to know is whether or not a black person ends up getting shot and killed, well, that does happen, that there is an ongoing narrative, and we keep using the word ongoing narrative. Narrative just means story. This is a storyline. This is the way that it is progressing. It's going down this storyline, right? A leads to B, B leads to C, C leads to D. So you've got this ongoing narrative of the police, you know, harassing, stopping and frisking, and sometimes shooting and killing black people. Yeah. And there's always some excuse that goes back to this idea that I laid out at the very beginning of this podcast three hours ago, that black people are violent and in some way, shape, or form deserved it. And I'm starting to see, this is tragically, I'm starting to see more and more black people actually adopt
beginning to
the
believe
idea.
It.
But because like, it's I mean, the
conditioning.
Malice,
right.
The Malice Green story.
One less thug ain't going to hurt anything.
Because it's so vivid for Detroit, especially because, you know, Butzel and Nevers ended up spending. One spent about a year and a half in prison because he was, you know, it was appealed. Another spent, well, one spent about 2.5 years in prison. And then the other, because he had cancer, was released, and he served the rest on a tether, and he still is still free. But these police officers were found guilty, and this was one of the this was the premier case that actually this is what's so weird. Kim Worthy won a lot of, I guess, support from the black community because she saw to it that those police officers for the murder of Malice Green
didn't
went
that
to,
case make her.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, no, for black people it made her, and then her sending Mayor Kilpatrick to prison for white people made her.
Okay,
so it's almost like she's like the you know, she ended up with both crowds, kind of.
Gotcha.
So I think the narrative, too, is just the way that we perceive. It's back to, like, how we look at police officers, you know, because many of the white, you know, the Nevers and the Butzel funds. Like, it was people doing Red Wing game fundraisers, and they raised a lot of money to support their campaign to get the appeal so they could not go to jail for the murder of Malice Green. And that's one of the things that took place right here in this region when you talk about the difference between inner city Detroit and suburban Detroit. I remember it vividly.
Kari, the problem is getting worse because if you look at historically, just overall numbers, police used to kill 350 to 400 people per year.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're at 680 just through second week in July.
Yeah.
And it's just, it doesn't, is this,
well, and does some of that go into the whole, and again, a whole nother conversation.
That'll be my podcast, which is launching next month. Here out of Podcast Detroit.
First guest.
The over-militarization of police.
Sure. Ooh. They bought all the excess supply.
I have a
supply.
Whole podcast episode about that after Ferguson happened because they showed up with to the protesters with tanks. I'm like,
with AMRAMs.
Why do you have tanks? Yeah. Why are your fingers on the trigger?
Military
right
was selling surplus to the police en masse. This has been going on for years.
Did anybody go to the Black Lives Matter protest, was it Friday night?
Yeah.
After what happened in Dallas, I was actually too scared to go downtown.
So I went. We had that conversation. We had a whole room for Steak Friday, and we talked about this issue. We've been talking about this in groups of black people for the last couple of days. And at the end of that, we went down to the rally.
Mm-hmm.
And we're walking down what street is that on the way to Campus Martius? Is
Woodward?
Huh?
No. Monroe?
Monroe. No, you know it's where DXF and stuff is.
Monroe,
right? So we're on the way.
Named after William C. Monroe, who was the first pastor of Second Baptist Church.
Ask the tours guy.
Right, there you go.
So we're walking down. I didn't forget Woodward. We're walking, and the street that crosses, I think, is Farmer.
Mm-hmm.
On that street, when we walked by, this is when we got scared. It was cool and everything when we were already just normally afraid of the police. So we cross Farmer, we look to our right, and there's a gigantic combat SWAT vehicle off to the side. And it was massive, black police officers all around it. Like, it was off to the side, so you couldn't see it from Campus Martius. But literally one block.
But it was there.
And no, they weren't filming Red Dawn 2.
No.
You know,
right.
Where they blew up the old movies, right?
I have a lot of friends with video of it. And we all stopped, and we all had that moment like, they're ready for us to act up. And for them to suppress us.
Yeah, not like, handle,
not
disperse.
They're ready to suppress.
Yeah, no problem with that suppression.
And
it'll be a Tiananmen Square 5-minute ordeal.
It was terrifying. So we get to the protest or the gathering or whatever you want to call it. There was never really a name for it. I believe they call it Black Friday. So we get over there. And it was then I did a slap and we walked past these guys. I didn't even notice the guys. So my friends said, hey, do you see those white guys? Cause I don't know. Maybe I just had my like ignore white people blinders on. Like I wasn't a bad. Like we were just together, you know, dealing with this community crisis. And we look over and there's three or four white guys, with the solid just the hillbilly outfit on, sleeves off, open carrying, at this protest. At the Black Lives Matter joint, and they were just standing there like passing each other ammunition. And I'm like, and they were,
so they were
there
seeking
for
attention.
Most of the time.
They were looking for attention.
Exactly.
And so we're thinking, so I'm like, yo, if you need to suppress some damn body, you need to suppress them. Because, of course, we didn't go to the rally with guns. Because there's a giant SWAT vehicle. Because we knew what would happen. but they felt completely within their rights and laws and comfortable to come to an all-black people event about police shooting black people.
That is white privilege at its highest. Right,
that's the first thing that came to my mind.
If I have ever heard
so much
of
privilege.
White privilege, yeah. Like,
no.
That is a privilege that you get to do that. We don't have that privilege.
We had,
see that tank there?
I controlled so many people from the SWAT to the guys with the guns saying, hey, it's going to be okay. And I could be lying like a mug.
And I hate that term, just I'll be frank.
White privilege?
But that totally makes good right there. I'll go, yeah. I agree with you.
It's white privilege. Like, white privilege is the realest
thing. And okay, so here's the thing about white privilege. I know people don't like the term. So I think what people need to define their terms, one. So when we talk about white privilege, you're just saying, hey, look, there are certain things that you have access to, that you have capabilities for, that we as black people and brown people do not have access to naturally. And that's not something that – and I think when people hear white privilege, they're like, oh, my gosh, you want me to feel guilty for being born white. Like, I don't want you to feel guilty for being born white. I just want you to know that certain things happen that – you know, to us that don't happen to you. Like, Dave Chappelle joked about this in his Killing Me Softly stand-up. He's got a white person in the front row of his stand-up, and he goes, hey, you know, you ever get pulled over by the cops? What do they say to you? License and registration, right? Yeah, they don't say that to us. Spread your cheeks and lift your sack, right? You know, it's like, I got ID too. It's like, and so, I mean, that was an exaggeration, of course, but it was observational humor that every black person in that audience was like, that's exactly right. Those aren't the questions that they generally, those aren't the things that they say.
See, when I first heard the term, I perceived it as, you didn't need to work hard for what you have because it was.
No.
Right, but no. As I'm hearing more and talking more, no. The police thing, I completely get because I put myself in every situation I've ever been in my entire life, and go like, oh my god, I should have been,
but
like completely destroyed in that situation. I think,
I think the defensiveness in even everything. I mean, you know, back to when I began in this discussion, like we're innate to male privilege. A certain black privilege, a certain woman privilege. It's privileges you have just based on prejudices that we have built as a society. And in this nation, there are certain white privileges that, you know, you can't shake.
Let me see your ID real quick.
So it's one of those things that just exist. I think that
well, you look at from a standpoint of you've seen the people put on fat suits and go on the street and how they're perceived versus the skinny attractive,
yeah. So,
right?
So again, here's how white privilege works. Okay, Carrie Bayette Frazier coming through on a resume has, let's say we're both qualified,
same qualifications.
What's your last name?
Walton Spiel.
Walton Spiel. Okay, so you both have the same qualifications. Your name's Bob. His name's Carrie. Spelled a little weird.
Kari.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Bayette. Is that correct?
Bayette.
Okay. All right. So I see that as generally as a white person. So someone sees it. Okay. I'm not even going to really consider that guy. But your name, Walton Spiel. Oh, okay. Cool. This is a white guy. Mm. Seems could have the same pedigree. You're automatically going to be considered above this person. Now, he might actually be better than you.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the name, there's that privilege. And again, it's like nothing that you should feel ashamed of. Like, you didn't give yourself a name. Your parents gave you a name. His parents gave him his name. And they shouldn't be. But here's the thing. His parents shouldn't have to feel like, I need to name my kid Bob Walton Spiel. I shouldn't have to do that. I should be able to I should be able to lean as hard into my culture as I want to. Don't name your kid LaMangelo.
I would interject with
whatever
this
the hell
too,
you
though.
Want to. If you want LaMangelo, we should look at your pedigree.
I'm going to make fun of your kid if you name him LaMangelo.
Because, you know, in the past, like, you know, I don't know, in the past, like, 6 months, you know, I've been around these dudes, like, at least every week. So, I mean, it's still, like, a certain amount of, it's still so tough because when we talk about diversity, I even struggle with this. Because we generally, black or white or whatever, we assimilate to what we feel more comfortable with, and that's what we identify with most. So whatever that may be. As a man, I'm probably identifying with a man more often. So when an opportunity opens where I'm contracting out, I'm not clearly saying to myself, man, you know, I want to hire another dude. But chances are, it's a higher probability that I'm hiring a guy.
And Kari,
I'm hiring a black dude because I'm closer to black people. I'm closer to what I know, and I'm not going to necessarily keep going through resumes or contracting and listings. Diversity is one of the toughest things I struggle with because it's an ideal that we talk about, but how do you reach that if you're not already diverse in your social circle already, and you don't just walk around and say, man, I don't have an Asian friend, and you're an Asian. I want to have an Asian friend so I can be diverse. Can you be my Asian homie? That doesn't make, you know, people don't
right.
do that.
But look,
don't
respond well
but
to look,
that.
Can you be my Asian token?
But yes, exactly. How do you get to that point when
diversity,
an opportunity opens up?
I think diversity with intent is necessary and real.
But how do you get
but
to
let
that
me
point?
But this is how because we do it on purpose. And sometimes you need to actively seek other people that are unlike you. It feels screwed up, but let me tell you why you have to do that, right? It's because you have to begin to build coalitions with different people, because we grow up with people who are like us, in neighborhoods with people who believe what we believe, mm-hmm. based upon
homogeneity.
And all go to the same church, and all go to the same
church. We speak the same languages. We hang out with the same folks.
Yes.
If you don't want to do that, you have to on purpose do something else. We purposely say we need a broader client base.
Yep.
And so we reached out to people who are unlike us, and we didn't know them at first, but now we do. How did we do that? We went to places that inherently, like, everybody say, hey, Eric and Marcus, come to this thing. I say, I'm sorry, guys. I already know all you guys. There's a thing with people I don't know. We're going to go to that. And so we built over time. But here's what happened, which is interesting. Now we are able to, when we do things, now it diversifies the events that we hold. Because we have brought these two communities together. Like, you know, Tom Lawrence is the homie.
Yeah.
And Tom Lawrence hosted Steak Friday. The Steak Friday we talked about Black Lives Matter and all that stuff, that was the Steak Friday that Tom Lawrence hosted. Mm-hmm. It wasn't supposed to be on purpose that way.
Right.
But now his community has seen this. Tom was there for a full conversation.
And you were holding hands with him that whole time when you see that SWAT truck, weren't you?
Oh, man. Tom actually left before we went to the rally.
Tom, hold me. Tom, hold me.
Not my scene, guys. Good like, conversation, though.
That's enough.
I'm good here in your office, but not out in public.
not in real life. Yeah.
We love you, Tom.
You're able to build those coalitions. It, like I said, it sounds weird, and it sounds uncomfortable. But that's because it is uncomfortable, and it should be.
But let's. But this is what I'm saying, though.
Not live in an echo chamber.
In business, though, when the decision is to be made, and I say, like, you know, my business is doing a lot better this year than last year, and better last year than it did the year before, and I'm growing, and I'm, you know, I can say most of my contracts probably. 3/4 of my contracts are probably from white-based businesses or somebody white. That's the check decider. 25% are black based. When I spend money, I'm probably, it's 50-50 of women. I mean, I'm all over the board when I spend money. But when I do decide to write a check myself, I'm talking about when I'm the check writer, I'm not allowing myself the luxury of finding out, can I be diverse? I'm trying to find who's the person that's going to deliver the best results the best way. So,
but a lot of that is perception based.
That's very pragmatic.
But I'm trying to say, even when you guys make that decision,
when you open up your checkbook,
we're talking about different needs here. I mean, there's overlap, but we're talking about different.
But I'm just saying straight up, we are all in business. When you open up your checkbook, how do you diversify it to have a candidate that's not like you?
But I tell people this all the time. Because you have to think about what you want, right? Like, we talk about women in the same context, too. I tell people all the time, I want my company to be 50% women. And for a long time, it was. The two women that worked for me both happened to, like, one quit and one got another job, right? But I focus on that. Now, so when it was time for me to hire some new people, we got one intern that was brought by his mom. We got one guy that found me, and I made sure I went and found a woman. And I'm still looking for women. I got another young lady that wants to join. Before, I hired two female graphic designers and artists and stuff. When you think graphic designer, you don't usually think woman, right? Mm-hmm. We go out of our way to find them.
Because so you do spend the extra time and money.
Yes.
So and absolutely. See, whereas I'm going to try to say I definitely don't give myself that luxury, so I don't necessarily know if I blame the white company if they have somebody, a position that needs to be filled, and they fill it with a white guy. I don't know if I'm so mad about that.
I'm super duper mad about that, and this is why. I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
Because the perception that black people aren't as good as things is pervasive. And it's not that they're not as good at things. And let me tell you how I know they're as good as things. Because the content that is being consumed from hip-hop to art to culture is being bred inside of African-American communities. They are then being taken, molded, and marketed
by
white companies. And then they're saying, oh, yeah, we couldn't hire a black guy to do this. We just had to get it from a black guy to sell this. Like, wait, why did we have to put a bridge in there? Why did we need a white distributor to sell it instead of just having the black guy sell his own product?
All this is
happening.
But
you don't think that's a luxury, though, to interview?
It is.
Like, if you are interviewing 10 candidates and you need somebody to step into that position right now and you find a guy that happens to fit all of the qualifications, you just keep interviewing until you get a woman?
Yes. And let me tell you
and
why.
And see, I would say that makes her a predisposition where I'm saying I'm giving her a bias advantage.
Let me tell you why we give her a bias advantage.
Okay.
Because the things that
this
different
is what you
people,
and I disagreed with on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I totally disagreed with you on this.
This is why. Because the things people bring to the table are not all on the spreadsheet of their technical ability, right? Mm-hmm. We can train for technical ability. What's hard to train for is culture and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a workspace that is all men, we don't understand women.
Correct.
Like this discussion right now.
If I bring women in who are not necessarily as technically trained as some of their male counterparts, but mm-hmm. have a different understanding of the world, what they bring to the conversation is new ideas and different perspectives. With black people, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, Jews, my business partner is a devout Christian. I am a complete atheist.
Mm-hmm.
I have atheists in my organization. I have women in my organization. I have no degree. My business partner went to Michigan. We just hired a new young black girl who has a minor in Japanese, a film degree, and she just graduated with a master's from Ross. Now, she speaks three languages and learning a fourth. Now, if I would have told you to go find somebody who speaks three languages, has a master's degree, has three degrees, you wouldn't have pictured a young black 23-year-old girl.
When will it be to a point where you hire a white man? Where your company hires a white man?
That's a great question. Because right now I have an Indian guy named Shriyash.
Okay.
Who found us.
His name is Triash?
Shriyash.
Not going to try it.
Nope. Shriyash.
I'm sorry if you're listening,
hard.
Bro.
It's been hard to say his name. I'm not going to lie to you. But he found us. We talked about it. He's a developer, but he has all these different experiences. But I don't like a lot of the people that we hire. There's one young girl that we hire, people that we have to train and teach and all that kind of stuff. We teach design, and we teach all these technical skills, because technical skills are technical skills. Yeah. If I want to teach you how to cut grass, I can teach you how to cut grass.
Yeah.
What I cannot teach you is 25 years of the black experience.
Right.
What I cannot teach you is 37 years of being a woman and being discriminated against.
Same thing with 50 years of the white guy experience.
Exactly.
The average guy that's hired. When will it get to the point where you hire the 50-year-old white guy?
So pragmatically.
We know one of my business mentors is a 60-year-old.
I'm not saying mentor. I'm saying you open your checkbook.
They're expensive.
Here's the thing.
Now, there's the thing. They're also expensive.
True story.
They're very expensive. 50-year-old white guys are very expensive. Yeah. My team is young.
They come with a lot of experience and expect a lot higher pay.
Exactly.
Keep going. Keep going.
So the only thing for me is, you know, at what point does it become too costly? You know, does the search become too costly? We need the person now. We're not finding what I want a woman. I'm not finding it. We need this project done now. We need this expertise. This guy is available. Or this girl who doesn't have the experience that I want is available, or this guy that I have available but doesn't have the experience is available, but we're losing money. So then it becomes pragmatic for me. But all of this, this question has to take place, and I want to turn the conversation a little bit here for a reason, because I wanted to get on this a little while ago, so I'm bringing it back. But all of what you're talking about, all multiculturalism, all this kind of stuff takes place because of a postmodern worldview. Okay, which is very deconstructionist worldview. Takes apart everything at its core. Nothing has meaning for the most part. What's true for you is true for you. What's true for me is true for me. What I value is just as valuable as what you value, even though they could be. What you could be doing is morally reprehensible, But that's true for you. Right? Mm-hmm. So we get into things now like the Black Lives Matter movement. Okay. And we lack thing. Well, we don't lack. Okay. We don't lack. Here's the issue. People with Black Lives Matter. And I'm not saying that I agree with everything that they talk about. Right. But people say, well, Black Lives Matter lacks leadership. Oprah Winfrey came along and said this. Right.
Oprah, I mean, said, that's an antiquated look.
It's an antiquated look. Right. Right. Movement. Now, here's the thing. It lacks leadership. Okay. Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, Sean King is a great speaker, you know, mm-hmm. for Black Lives Matter, right?
And Duray.
Yeah.
And just got arrested.
Now you got Jesse Williams. Jesse. Right. Okay. So you've got all these people who are actually leadership. But what you do lack in this postmodern world, which is, again, why you're having the conversation that you're having about multiculturalism in ways that you don't even – again, history, people don't realize the history they've inherited, why they're thinking this way. So you've inherited the modernist worldview that now has morphed into this postmodern worldview, which is the purview of people who are 18 to 35 years old at this point. Right? Mm-hmm. So you have people who are saying things like Black Lives Matter doesn't have leadership. Mm-hmm. Well, people will also then point to, see, Black Lives Matter doesn't have leadership, but the civil rights movement, they had leadership. Look at this. They had Martin Luther King. Like, oh, he was the leader. Like, Martin Luther King was a leader. He was not the leader. And he is historically the person.
Really, historically, he was not accepted by the CLC.
Historically, he's the person that you need to point to in order to prove your point now, because you want black people to remain nonviolent, right?
True.
So we're going to point to him. But you had Medgar Evers.
Because they lived
in. You had, you know, Malcolm X. You had, I mean, a host of other people. You know, you had a host of other people. Marcus Garvey. I mean, you had all these people who were civil rights leaders.
But under that movement, Martin Luther King was not accepted.
Right.
He wasn't. That's why he had to create his own
right
marches. I mean, even in Detroit right now, where they honor his, you know, the Detroit NAACP never supported Dr. Martin Luther King. It was Reverend C.L. Franklin, Aretha Franklin's father,
yep.
that said, yo, I get behind this guy. I'm going to ship him some money. I support him because I support his father. But a lot of black people did not support Dr. Martin Luther King. So, it's revisionist history.
Yeah, people have no idea about history. I don't even know that it's revisionist history. It's just people that don't study history. It's like he did say some of the, he said all the things that you're saying he said, but he also said all these other things that you're not talking about.
But even Condoleezza Rice with her father. She said, well, you know, my father said he wanted to support him, but he didn't really want to support him at the fact of possibly losing his job.
So
which that's one way of looking at it.
Right.
But as far as you could say, to say I didn't want to lose my job, so I didn't support him, it still doesn't negate the fact of the ending of that sentence is he didn't support him.
Right. So the contention that I have as a Christian, someone who does believe, you know, in God, does believe the Bible's word of God, does believe that Jesus is the Son of God, believe these things, here is something that our generation lacks, okay? Our generation does lack a spiritual center, a spiritual grounding. Because with postmodernism, we no longer respect or see as any kind of moral authority the church, right? So Martin Luther King Jr. is what? Reverend. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., right? Yeah. So he's a reverend, and at that time, we afforded some sort of moral authority to the church. Mm-hmm. Not just the black church, just the church in general. Then we move into the culture where, okay, you know, the Catholic Church is just kind of shuffling around these priests who are molesting these kids, and hey, you know, this guy is saying, hey, tithe into my church, but then all the people are poor in my church, and then he's driving around in a caddy. And so the church is having this less and less of this authority. So we say we don't trust cops. We don't trust anybody who's an authority. Honestly. We don't trust the government. They're all crooked.
It's a millennial idea. We don't have reason, but
by and large, our generation does not trust authority
in
general.
It's a millennial ideal to not trust institutions because our whole generation, we've seen institutions that are age old.
Right. But historically,
your parents lose all their money in their 401k.
Right, but
you see your older brother go to college, get a master's degree, and not be able to sustain a job.
Right.
Exactly. Well, so you lose faith in these institutions.
Right, but there's no generation that has not felt disillusioned with the generation before them. What has been handed to them? No generation has ever come along.
I agree with you. My parents got this all right. I agree with you.
So they always come along and like, man, my parents really screwed up the world. I'm going to do it better. Right.
I agree.
Meanwhile, the parents are like, "You were so ungrateful. Like, we were like the people who were protesting all this, and you got the." But again, people don't like to study history. This is why I study history. Why it's important. Yeah. You should study history. But anyway, What I'm trying to get at is now you have leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. You do have them. I don't care what people say when they say it lacks leadership. No, it has leaders. It has people who are speaking. It has people who are writing. It has people who are protesting. It has people who are going on the news and saying articulately, this is what we believe. This is what we are saying. Don't listen to the guy who's out there shooting cops and trying to usurp our message. This is what we believe. This is the core. But you have a generation of people now that lacks a spiritual core that can we can all point to whether we agree. Okay, so like Eric, you said, I'm an atheist. But an atheist back in 1960 would at least still afford some moral authority to the church. Okay, hey, you know what? I'm an atheist. I don't believe your fairy tales. But you guys do a lot of good things, and you lead people towards a lot of good things, so I can at least get on board with you there. Well, now the church is antiquated and backwater. Their ideas are crazy. We don't need to follow them. Look how they're not doing anything with AIDS research. They're keeping people with AIDS in Africa, and you know they're against homosexuals. So they're antiquated and backwater. They have no authority. And so now you have a generation of leaders who are coming up, but they don't have that spiritual authority grounding that people flocked to with the leaders of the civil rights movement. We don't have that anymore. There's no assumed moral authority whatsoever. That is going to be a problem that needs to be addressed. You cannot do it with some sort of grounding. And I'm not saying that your grounding has to be – I mean, as a Christian, I believe that your grounding needs to be spiritual. But if you don't have some sort of grounding, which nobody has right now
– I think like we have our feet, a grounding in reason.
They have a grounding in reason, but their feet are still firmly planted in midair because anybody in a postmodern milieu can say, you know what? That's cool and true for you, but that doesn't work for me.
But here's the thing. I think that's always been a thing. I mean,
it hasn't been an overarching
Christian
cultural thing.
Christians used to say it's all good and true for you that you wanted to love the man that you wanted to, but that's not cool for me, so we're going to put you in the back somewhere. Right? The situation is thus. There are many cultural movements happening right now at the same time.
Yes.
Faster.
It's always been the case.
Faster than at any other point in history. I might have to write about this.
I can agree to that.
This is what I might want to write about this because I think what I'm tired of people doing is talking shit about the social media and the millennial movement. I want to talk about the power of millennials in their collectivism, as people call it, right? Because they always complain. They say the millennials, they don't really protest. They don't do things.
Slacktivism,
right. Now, I liked it. I did my job.
But here's the thing.
Hashtag about, helping.
Right.
But here's the thing about this. I think we deny the power of that because we don't understand what gets things done. Like, we talk about history. We also have to look at motives and how things happen. Well, lately, I've been talking about social equity. Things get done because you have social equity, especially great cultural revolutions, because people all begin to believe the same thing. There's never been a situation where the mass populace voted for everybody to be better at the same time, right? Like, like seven guys abolished slavery, not America as a whole. we got to stop pretending like America came around on voting rights.
They came dragging and kicking.
Dragging and kicking. What social media has allowed people to do is actually let everyone vote on if we give gay people rights, if we let gay people use bathrooms. And let me tell you how. Whenever someone posts a thing that's like, oh, we don't like gay people, the internet appears and says, fuck you.
Yeah.
They say, fuck that and you and them and everything you stand for. Fire him. And then they send his picture and his name and his comments to his job, and he's gone.
His address and his phone number.
And he's gone.
Even when that original situation didn't ever really happen, that's the problem.
True. But here's the thing. It does get out of hand.
Yep.
But if you look at how fast these rights movements, like the civil rights movement was long and arduous, and many people died on the way.
Yep.
Getting gay people the right to get married took a long time until all of a sudden millennials grabbed it and rammed it through. Same way with transgenders using bathrooms. This idea about transgenders using the same bathrooms like appeared like 2 years ago, for real. And it got rammed through fast as heck. So now Target doesn't have gender bathrooms, all that kind of stuff, because social equity was built off of people saying at the same time, we believe this to be true.
It did, because I did not even realize that was a movement.
You never heard of that movement until it appeared and we rammed it through. Then we were like, oh, gay people should get married. rammed it through. We were like, oh, you know what? Have you heard about Afro-Latinos? We were like, well, maybe. Nope. Rammed it through. And all of a sudden, okay. It's not that it happened. What I'm saying is that the speed at which these cultural revolutions are happening now are much faster because social media gives more voices to more people at more times.
I think you're right and you're wrong. I think the ramming it through is categorically historically false.
I think we ram it through every time.
No, all of these things have taken years. I mean, you can go all the way back to it's a book called After the Ball. Okay. And it is a book that is essentially the strategy for cultural engagement for the homosexual lobby. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't have a problem if you have an agenda. People are like, oh, homosexual agenda. Look, you have an agenda. You want to get rights. Have an agenda. That's fine. That's totally cool, right? So I have this book, which is essentially the playbook, all right? And that was written in the 80s. And it has been what they have operated from since the 80s. Because being gay in the 80s, that was not a good time.
It was bad.
That was not a good time.
It was bad for everybody.
And so it took everything
really
that was written in that book to get to the Obergefell decision.
The more different you are, the further back in time you go.
So
it ain't good for
I don't want anybody to sit here and think that the decision that the Supreme Court came to was millennials just ramming this thing through. This was something that's been going on since the 80s, pushing this particular message. Whether you agree with it or not, this is historically what had to happen. So, yes, we do have people pushing things through. They're still taking more time. What's happening is the proliferation of information is happening at a faster rate than you've ever seen. But the information has always been there, and people haven't had access to it.
Well, here's the thing. You made the point earlier about the right to vote.
Right.
Yes, the right to vote did appear on the books. But then they were like, psych.
Right.
If social media would have existed at that time, say people were able to build that consensus. As soon as, because people were able to not believe it. Right? We were like, oh no, they're not letting me vote. White people were like, no, that sounds crazy. You know, like, and then all of a sudden it was like, and then people were getting beat up left and right. If you were able to be like, if you were able to post online, like, look, everybody. Because how long have we been getting killed by police officers?
The proliferation
is the video of us getting killed by police officers.
It's the information availability.
That's what I'm saying.
Right, it's like now we have video, right? The cameras are there.
Consensus around, hey, this is not only happening, but there's valid stake in these things. So, yes, I understand that people are saying it's not activism to click like, but it is.
But what does that mean? What does that mean long term? So right now you are in it, okay? So it's going to take our children, our grandchildren to look back and historically understand what we're talking about now. Like this is, they were in it, so they couldn't see the forest for the trees, right? So now we have historical perspective. So what does that all mean? Because you're talking about, the proliferation of, information. It's happening faster. So the Arab Spring happened a few years, right?
Right.
Okay, that entire region now, we championed it a few years ago. That entire region is destabilized now, completely destabilized.
True.
All right? All that push through social media, as you were saying. So it's not always ending up with the good result. That,
good.
No.
It just happens faster.
It is.
Because who are we to decide what's good?
Right.
I mean, yes, we can say that.
We are absolutely someone to decide that something is good.
Well, no, here's the thing. Well, it, depending on.
I mean, this kind of goes back to that moral.
Yeah, let's go back to moral.
Because
if I can't determine that you killing Jewish people is wrong and morally reprehensible, if it's, oh, that's true for you, I can't blame you for the color of your eyes and your blonde hair.
Yeah, but we always say that. Like, we always talk about, like, how immoral killing is until you got to kill somebody, right? Until somebody's got your kid hostage and you got to kill them or watch your kid die. Then all of a sudden, the moral ambiguity appears.
I need you to come down at a place, and it's not just I'm trying to attack the atheist here. I need you to come down on a place where you have to understand that we are in it. We say, who am I to judge? That's our generation. We are absolutely the only ones who can judge. We have to judge. If we cannot judge that something is morally wrong or morally right, then you can't sit here and be like, oh, well, you know what? We pushed, you know, these bigoted people over here, they're just backwater and, you know, they're against homosexuality. We had to push that through because they're wrong. No, you can't say that someone is wrong. That's you judging. We can say
things that we believe in, but what happens is that if a multitude of people believe the same thing, then they begin to drown out the noise of the people that believe a different thing.
But
now that sounds evil.
It's the language that you use to describe the people that you're trying to drown out that is judgmental.
What you were just saying, though,
is who am I to judge?
Well,
you were making a judgment
call.
What I'm saying is that it all goes back
to this moral ambiguity.
Why is it morally ambiguous?
Because things change based upon the situation. If you're going to say, If you're going to say that killing is wrong, that means that killing is wrong in every situation. There are many people, including myself, that believe that killing is not wrong in every single situation. If it comes, if it's between you and my grandma, dog, I'm picking my grandma every time. Every time. If it's between you and my daughter, I'm picking my daughter every time. If anybody here could tell me that's different, let me know.
I think murder is wrong in every situation.
And I hear you. Unless you're about to kill my daughter, and then I'm picking you every time. And let me know if I'm off on that one. If you got a gun to my daughter's head, I'm about to take the sniper shot.
And then you turn into Liam Neeson and you become a Taken and you don't care who's getting in your way.
I don't know who you are.
I got a particular set of skills.
I don't know where you are.
You know, that's what I'm saying. That's why it worries me. People are like, oh, we got this moral authority. Because, yes, you can decide against my daughter, but I can't.
Well, but so...
But you're making a moral decision there.
Well, and not only that, but doesn't that get back to your point, Calvin, about that lack of... a morality-based leadership being grounded.
If you don't have
because if it is, and this is one of the downsides of social media, is it is so instantaneous. Like, you know, we've seen study after study that 70% of the people don't read beyond the headline.
Which is dangerous.
They don't read beyond. So it's
just comment.
But this is where
this is where you get white people, or they share, which is even more dangerous.
White people, conservatives, I'm sorry, again, I don't want to sound racist here, but this is where you can get white people saying, why should I believe what you have to say? Why should I have to care? Like, I'm going to care about the cops that are getting shot. I don't have – and we're over here going, well, why aren't you caring about the black people getting shot by the cops?
Well, I
don't have to care about that.
But
you can care about that.
That takes us to another point, which is a question and a discussion that we need to have. All lives matter.
That's a whole other story, right?
Oh, my God.
all lives matter.
All lives matter.
Should we have that conversation right now?
Well, I would love to have an all-lives matter conversation.
We are at 4.5 hours.
We've bumped up against it. Well, we're at 4:08. Is where we are currently.
All right, 408. All right. So I got about another half hour.
Billy, I said this early on the thing. It's like going to the Susan Komen Cancer for a Cure 5K and screaming, why aren't you talking about male colon cancer? Why aren't you talking about male colon cancer? It's like, because we're here for Susan Komen breast cancer. Where were you yesterday before we started this? Like, no, we're not talking about that. And to me, it's when you think about it, when I looked at it first, I'm like, yeah, true, all lives matter because I think like that. But then I looked at it, broke it down. I'm like, well, no, it's like bitching about, you know, when you're here for this.
Well, it's that invisible only that I keep hearing about now. It's the perception that when someone says Black Lives Matter, there's an only.
Well, me too.
In front of it.
Me too. Well,
yeah,
you know, no, it's not what we're talking about, you know.
But does that come from the culture of everyone gets a trophy?
Yep,
it's a perspective.
Thanks for participating.
When black people see Black Lives Matter, we add two. When white people see Black Lives Matter, they add only to the front. You know, like, we both add an invisible word. It's just from which way we're looking.
Calvin, I'm not going to lie. When I saw you post Don't Kill Cops on your Facebook, I didn't want to add because I didn't want to, like, squirt gas on it, but I want to say, like, how about don't kill anybody? Right? Yeah. But then at the same token, I'm like, you know what? I'm not even going to step in there because I don't know what the message is.
It's cops who are getting shot right now. That was the only thing. It's like, yeah, don't kill anybody, for sure.
How about just know nobody? Right. Let's just – can we all agree on that one,
sure,
you know?
But that is something that it's unspoken, right? I mean – of course you don't kill people. But when someone says Black Lives Matter, that should – there's a reason for that.
And
we're not taking the time – the people that are saying, well, all lives matter. I don't see color. You're not taking the time to understand the reason behind Black Lives Matter.
It's just like the ONS. The only Lives Matter group that is protested is Black Lives Matter. Nobody's protesting Blue Lives Matter. Like, whenever you see, like,
well, no, there actually were a lot of them in Dallas yesterday.
Well, but you rarely see, like, the hashtag. Like, I posted this the other day. I was like, how come Blue Lives Matter isn't met with Civilian Lives Matter? Like, nobody's, like, questioning that civilian lives matter. And nobody's questioning that police lives matter.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's like nobody's like coming to them like, oh, yeah, you know, blue lives matter. Oh, yeah, well, what about everybody who's – what about army lives? Yeah. Army lives matter. Like,
this is where you go back to cognitive dissonance, which you talked about in the first hour. It's like people are so and I have to have this conversation. I actually got an email from someone a message on Facebook saying, hey, you know what? I'm grateful for how level-headed your conversations are. I could never have those kind of conversations that you're having on Facebook. But – I sometimes have to have conversations or ask a question with people who are like, hey, do you want to have a conversation with me or are you so committed to your point of view that you just want me to listen to you give it? Mm-hmm. Do you want to have a conversation, or are you so committed to this idea that anything that I have to say in rebuttal is, you know, basically throwing my pearls before swine? Like, you don't, I mean, the verse in the Bible, don't throw your swirls, pearls before swine, because they'll just trample it underfoot. Mm-hmm. What do pigs know about pearls, right? They're just going to put them in the mud. And so I have to ask that question. Are you committed to this idea? And I think so many people are committed to their own viewpoint, to their own ideas about something, that they are not open to having it, having the tires of their view.
I learned a new phrase. This week, sea lioning. Like, I didn't know that was a thing.
I don't know.
Like, apparently, so that's the term on social media, where, because if you've ever seen sea lions fight, they basically go, like, and they just, like, wail up against each other.
Okay.
So sea lioning is when you have no intention of having a good conversation or ever agreeing with the person you're commenting on, but you just keep popping up and doing the, well, but what about?
Right. You're not even committed. Sometimes you're not even committed to the idea. You just like to start fights on Facebook.
I
mean, that's,
I have a lot of those people on my face. You've seen my face.
Bizlocked. Yes. Blocked.
I don't block people. Deleted. Like, that's the thing that I do not do. I let people just be an idiot in public.
That's the opportunity cost of everyone having a voice, that you're going to have a lot of people like that that don't want to engage in the discussion. Because Lord knows I have a lot of people on all sides of many different opinions.
Well, and that's the good touch and bad touch of social media.
It's the opportunity cost. Yep.
Yeah, so everybody gets a voice.
Everybody's voice is
equally valid. Everybody gets a voice.
But everybody,
this is what the electoral college is trying to solve.
Voice, everybody's voice isn't necessarily a voice that should be heard by everybody. You know,
this is where I ground, and this is where I say, this is where I make that judgment again. Who am I to judge? We're the only ones to judge. Your voice doesn't matter. What you are saying is ridiculous and stupid, and you should shut up. The problem is, because everybody's opinion is equally valid, when I say that, it's just one other opinion. So someone else who's like, I don't think Black Lives Matter, you're stupid, you're dumb, and you should shut up.
What helps me with that, though, is I'm a big person on context. The more you understand the context of which someone comes from within their perspective, within their opinion, then the better you can understand a reasonable understanding of, like, okay, I understand. So, like, if like, Eric's, looking at Eric's feed is always a good time.
I don't think we're friends on Facebook. We go back and forth.
So when you look at Eric's feed, you know, and then it's like, okay, let me go a little bit further. You can click on the person's page. And then that's the cool thing even about social media. You can see some other things that a person posts. You can kind of see a little bit of
really
the person's
cool guy.
Background.
Eric just quoted a guy a couple hours ago. It was amazing.
You can see who they quote.
Oh, this guy, yeah.
You can see who they quote, how they quote them, you know? Mm-hmm. And then that gives you a better context to say, okay, I understand why they come from this perspective. Like I said, even with the Paula Deen thing, she was a woman born in the 40s in the South. Do I not expect her to use the word nigga? No.
Okay. That's why I think this is important. This is why
there were a few words that we talked about we couldn't use on the podcast.
You didn't say ER.
How many have we hit?
All of them. Okay, this is why I think that conversations...
We should have had the black stuff bingo card.
This is why I feel like...
a dollar in the N-word jar, as they say.
I've been trying to control N-word. Myself. It's my favorite word.
Conversations like this are very important because I have a guy, a friend, whose name is David Sidebotham, right? And he is he's an ally of feminists, right? And I grew up very... conservative, and I'm just like, feminism is just dumb, you know, whatever. Like, let me just give you a compliment. Why can't I just say that you look pretty? I don't mean anything by it. I'm not coming after you. But I didn't know about rape culture. And this guy kept pounding into me, and I was like, no, you're just dumb. But after multiple conversations and lots of frustration on his end and my end, I came to the realization, okay, this is a thing. This is a thing. And so I find that, okay, so that happens, but then there are times where I talk to people. I have my worldview. People have their worldview. I have my opinion. They have their opinion. At the end of the conversation, because we allow the conversation to take place, I can walk away from that conversation, just like you were saying, and go, you know what? I don't agree with you, but now I don't think you're an idiot. Yeah, I see where you're coming from.
Right.
I can no longer caricature and set up a fourth grade version of your viewpoint and make that the object of my attack. and knock that over.
Yeah.
Right? Now this is a very – and C.S. Lewis, great theologian. He wrote a book – he wrote Narnia. He wrote A Mere Christianity as well. But he talks about Christianity. He says normally when people attack religion, they set up a fourth grade version of the religion and they make that the attack, the object of their attack. But if you talk about prayer and you're like, hey, you know – if you look at a chair and you talk about a chair and like all the atoms coming together and all of a sudden sitting in a chair becomes this very complicated idea. It's like the same thing with prayer. It's like, hey, you know what? You're praying, but all these different things are happening when you're communicating with God. But nobody's attacking that version. They're attacking, hey, you know what? I didn't get my prayer answered in fourth grade by God, so he's going out the window with Santa Claus as well. And so that's the object of their attack. So same thing here is I can't take Eric's worldview and make that a caricature because I sat down with Eric and I've had the conversation.
Yeah, right? And then you can understand where he comes from. Like
that made sense, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, all right.
It makes perfect sense. And one of the best things for me, especially being, I mean, I grew up Davidson and Linwood. I spent most of my time on Dexter and Livernois. So meaning that as a child, interacting with white people, it's like, okay, this is either a police officer, somebody buying some drugs, or this is somebody that owns a property in my neighborhood. So being a truck driver, being in a place where I'm interacting with certain white people that have never seen a black person before in their life, is like, damn, I didn't really interact with that many white people. You don't interact with that many black people. I have to be prepared for an amount of what is at the point in time, them having an understanding of, you gotta be the colored fella coming to drop off the milk. And it's like, okay, and that's my white guy voice of whatever place.
That's the Midland voice.
So it's like, you know what? Yeah, now do I want to, do I feel like saying, throwing on an X-Clan CD and saying, you the devil? It's like, no, I mean, if he's interacting with very few white people, very few black people, Lord knows the perception that he's getting possibly from the media.
Mm-hmm.
You have to allow a level of understanding
right
before you even get like to a point of Paula saying thing. And that's the thing of context, and that's what's missing, I think, in a lot of these discussions, is we don't have the context. And one of the things, as much as I say I don't want to interact with an officer on duty, I can say this for the off-duty officer. The context of being a police officer in America today, being the crazy calls, especially if you're a police officer in my neck of the woods, you're getting called on some crazy shit. So I can only imagine the level of fear that the average officer has coming and patrolling my neighborhood.
I think officers need to be cycled. Like, I think officers need, like, a mandatory yearly, like, psychological eval.
Oh.
This gets back to the money.
Cycled.
It's not cycled. Enough money like, to
they
do
they
that.
They do get cycled.
What Bob said. Nobody
walks the same beat for 30 years.
32 Gs a year? They don't have enough money to go through cycling and
I remember. I'll just attribute to this. When I was security at the Palace in Pine Knob, and they put me on main floor for Pantera.
Pine Knob.
Thank you, yeah.
Pantera!
And I was in the main floor for Pantera, and the people said, when the lights go out, I'm rushing. I said, I make $6 an hour. You do what you want. Right? So I can't even imagine. So if I'm making 32 Gs, like, my God, the thought that must come through your mind.
And God forbid you get called to, it's a disturbance in the house, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, what the hell does this mean, a disturbance? And then it has to be one of the toughest and craziest positions to be in. You're generally dealing with people. I mean, even the whole situation that happened, I don't know what the hell happened with the guy that from the Ford family last week. But even that situation, it's like, oh, man.
Ford went home.
Okay, but still, to be the officer to show up at that situation, how scared are you? It's like, damn, if I don't handle this situation right.
Not scared at all.
Shit, I would be scared out of my damn mind, because if I don't handle this situation great, I may end up in the goddamn Detroit River. This is the Ford family right here. And he may be beating the shit out of his wife. And I'm like, hey, can you stop hitting your wife? And it's like, who's your boss? I pay for your food. And it's like, okay, I guess I got to let this guy
stop. Many white guy voices. Like,
he has about 37.
Here's
my question. So, and I know we got to wind this down here, because I know we're good. So now what? Like we say about almost every one of these topics we have, every one of these conversations we have, there's always the dot, 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 and then.
Now what? Okay.
So what's the end then?
Okay, so I said this in a podcast right after Ferguson. I've mentioned that several times here, but
it was a really good podcast.
Did you listen to it?
No, I just assumed
you're just making it. It was good. I mean, I sent it. But it was interesting listening to it again after all these new shootings took place, because it was really prophetic. But it was also really interesting to see how I've changed in my perspective since then. But I think one of the things is continuing the conversation, because here's what happens. Okay, so we have the 24/7 news cycle, so things get pushed out faster and faster because of social media and 24/7 news cycle, right? Well, eventually something else is going to happen that's going to take our attention away, right? And then the conversation is going to stop. And that's I think that's the main problem with this issue, is the conversation stops. Terms aren't defined. So it's like, hey, you know, we all feel passionately about these cops killing people and cops getting shot. And then things calm down, and the new Ghostbusters movie comes out next week, right? Well, let's go see Ghostbusters. I went and saw Secret Life of Pets last night. Like, that was great. It was nice levity. It was great. I took my daughter. It was fun. Next week's going to be Ghostbusters, and then the next week's going to be some Marvel movie, I think. Suicide Squad's coming out soon. It's like, okay, so all these movies come out, and we're entertained to death, right? So now our attention is off. Something's going to happen with, you know, something's going to happen with Kylie Jenner, and something's going to happen with, you know, with Kim Kardashian or whatever. Attention's going to be taken away. And the conversation's going to stop. Okay? What needs to happen, what now, is the conversation needs to continue. So 6 weeks from now, after this shooting has happened, we need to go, hey, let's check in. Let's check in. You know, what have you guys done? What conversations have you had?
Getting a phone call from me in 2 weeks. Calvin, how are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I had a conversation.
Do yes, sir, the
no,
police.
I mean, here's
please
the thing. Do. We do this when people die, okay? My mother-in-law, her husband died 2 years ago, okay? Just, what, a few days ago. My wife's nodding here. I mean, a few days ago, 2 years ago. And, you know, when someone dies, you're calling them. You're calling them immediately. You know, hey, what can I bring over? Can I bring you a lasagna? Can I bring you, you know, something to drink? You know, whatever. I will take care of your needs, okay? Well, then, like, 6 weeks later, you're still like, okay, well, you're not probably bringing the lasagna all the time, but you're still checking in.
Yeah.
Hey, Don, how are you? You had your husband for 40-plus years. How are you today, 6 weeks after losing him? And I think with the fact that America is collectively mourning, or at least the black community is collectively mourning over what has happened, checking in every now and then, hey, what's going on? What conversations are you having? Making that conversation still important, because for black people, we are literally waiting. We are literally waiting for the next shooting.
Oh, for sure.
That's what we're waiting for. So how are we in the meantime is a very important conversation to have. And listening to those conversations, I'm grateful that you guys made this space available and that you listen. I mean, Bob, at the beginning you were like, I don't got anything to say. I just want to hear.
Yeah.
That for us doesn't generally happen. That nice. Space is necessary. So I'm grateful for the both of you
had to
doing that.
I'm
not saying we need to have another podcast.
I was going
to
say so. I was going to ask.
We need a 5 hour podcast
every week.
Yeah, not saying we need a 5 hour podcast. But I like the fact that you open. I mean, I love the IT and the D doing. You have somebody from American Idol tomorrow, as far as I understand.
Yep.
You've got stuff that's just kind of, you know, sometimes lackadaisical. Hey, it's cool. It's pop culture. This is fun. I mean, I got to come in and talk about my tour company, but. I think having things, making it open for, hey, this crazy shit just went down. How do we deal with this? How do we process this together? How do we move forward towards a common goal? I think that it's important. And we've got other people on this podcast. I'm done talking.
I would like to say, this is what I want everybody to do. This is my, like, what do we do? I said this earlier in the podcast, and I've been saying it to everybody, and I'll say it again. I want you to think about your physiological reactions. When you react to someone, think about why. I'm talking about when you react to women. When there's a woman in a room and you're having a conversation, the woman begins to say some words and you feel the need to shut her down before she finishes her thought, I want you to think about that. When you feel the need to catcall a woman, or when you feel the need to cross the street when you see a black person, or when you feel the need to not trust white people with your money, or when you feel the need to change the channel when you see somebody talking, that's a thing. Like, I need you to think about why. And I want you to make a decision after you thought about why, not after you just felt what you felt. Because that is the most important thing. When you see me and I'm the black guy, I don't want to be the black guy that may or may not know marketing. I want you to say, is he the guy who knows marketing that happens to be black? And so you have to reprogram yourself to start thinking about why and not just reacting to why. That for me is the most important thing you can take away from experience like this. Why did Philando Castile get shot? Because Philando Castile was terrifying to the man that shot him. Why was he terrifying to the man that shot him? Because culture has taught us that that man is dangerous. But why? That police officer did not know Philando Castile. And in reality, he was a mentor, a youth activist. He had that permit that he legally, and he was not the man he thought he was. And we need to be able to decide that that man is not the man that we think he is based upon a gut reaction.
Regardless of what he's wearing, sideways hat.
Yeah, regardless of what
doesn't.
He's wearing,
yeah,
it's time to like it's time to start meeting people as people and think about how we feel about them. So that's my two cents on what we need to do from starting today. Or 300 years ago.
Those two senses, thank you for being, you know, putting this together and willing to listen, ask questions.
He's a man out here.
You guys have exhausted me.
Did you just say amen?
I said he's a man out here.
Oh, I thought he said amen. And I was like, oh, okay.
I was like, what?
Lordy, we're making some progress.
He was going...
take like three
irons. Just warmed out over the course of 5 hours. You got Eric to convert to Christianity.
Right. Give me some time. Give me some time, right? God's patient. Let's go.
Just thank you for letting, you know, and I know that you put yourself out there to do that. We've had some history and some misunderstandings and how that can go, but it's an important conversation to have, and, you know, this is a step.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, definitely. Bob, Dave, Nuri, IT and the D, I support it. This forum, I don't know how many people are definitely, if you're listening to all these hours, god damn, you are a person job, that is hippie. Trying to, you are definitely See,
I might want to cut this one into segments. We might
I feel
have
like we should have dropped in like Easter eggs, like if someone says the keyword, that they get like a $5 gift certificate to something. To prove you listened.
That's right, free bus tour.
Yeah, right in the middle.
You get a black card for a day.
If you can name all six books Calvin mentioned over the course of it.
If you're black, you're going to get out of jail free card.
No, yeah.
Exactly. No. But
those don't exist. Don't listen to him.
Great. I think so much of it is, I think it's social. You know, interact, find out more, open those discussions, and hopefully you can come across definitely, I think any of the four of us would be, maybe not so much, I mean, make sure that you're respectful with Calvin. But, you know,
Eric, you can mess with all you want to, but Calvin.
Yeah, Eric, even me.
Say whatever you want.
You can say what you want, ask a question, find out if you feel like if you need better understanding from whatever culture. You know, please ask the question because it is through communication and through interaction that this can build. Like I say, I strongly suggest Autobiography of Malcolm X. It's other books too, but I strongly suggest that book. And
well, yeah, actually, I'm going to want to get titles and that kind of stuff from you guys. I'll throw them in the recap that we
actually,
do.
Actually, you know what? Since we're recording, let's say some of them so people have them. I got a few here, and we'll just go out. Oh, I'm going LeVar Burton style here. You don't have to take my word for it.
Little reading rainbow.
Not Kunta Kinte, LeVar Burton.
This is real reading, reading rainbow.
Not Roots LeVar Burton.
All right.
Not Jordy LeVar Burton.
Books, that's still good, LeVar Burton.
That's great.
But anyway, some books that I brought in that really informed a lot of what I had to say tonight. Hopefully you were able to follow along. Policing the Planet. Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter. It's edited by Jordan T. Camp and Christina Heatherton. The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit by Thomas J. Segrue. White Allies in the Struggle for Racial Justice, Drick Boyd. That's a religious title. Black Scholars in White Space by Anthony B. Bradley, who is probably one of the foremost authorities on black liberation theology. And then you have How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America by Manning Marable, who also wrote a fantastic biography on Malcolm X as well. So those are the books that I brought in that I think are now these are just a few out of my library that I think are really good reading that could help better understand some of where I'm coming from. They're pretty thick books, but if you're a reader like I am, you would enjoy having them in your library or checking them out from your local library.
Cool. Yeah. All right, thanks. All right, well, again, guys, seriously, especially given that we're at the 431 mark now, thank you for taking the time out of your weekends and days away from your family and everybody. Well, except for, you know, Calvin, who brought his wife with him.
No sacrifices.
I don't sacrifice time with the wife. That doesn't count.
I do really, really appreciate it. So, you know, on behalf of Bob and myself, thanks, guys. And, yeah, if you're still out there listening, thank you for paying attention and hopefully for caring and learning something. This has been, I don't know, episode 151 and a half.
And how much for one rib?
Why are we only
how much
half?
For one rib?
We were already three-fifths a man. How can we only get half an episode? Make it a full episode. Say,
this might actually have to be episodes.
Oh, see what I did there?
This might have to be episodes 152 and 153.
This is the 150X.
Well done. Well done.
Well played, Kari.
I should not use my cell phone. Sorry, FBI, if you were listening.
He does not want tickets or taxation.
Yep. All right, so this has been this episode. We'll figure out what to call it later. Thank you for listening. Appreciate it.
This is a previously recorded episode of the IT in the D Show.
IT in the D. Networking Detroit, one beer at a time.
ITinTheD.com.